Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you are listening to today's interview and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details or contact us at pr@speakuptalkradio.com. Well, I've been looking forward to today's guest since I discovered her website about her amazing African gray parrot named Cosmo. She is Dr. Betty Jean Craig, a university professor emerita of comparative literature at the University of Georgia. She lives in Athens, Georgia since 1973. Betty Jean is a teacher, scholar, translator, humorist, and writer. In 2010, she published Cosmo Talks, At Home with an African Gray Parrot. After retiring, she published a column about animal behavior in the local paper titled Cosmo Talks from 2011 to 2013, and then she began writing fiction. Her Witherston murder mystery series, set in North Georgia, includes Downstream, published in 2014, Fairfield's Auction in 2016, and Damn Witherston in 2017. She is currently writing a suspense thriller. And as a fellow bird lover, I am thrilled to introduce her and hopefully her bird friend Cosmo to everyone today. So welcome to the network, Betty Jean.
Thanks for having me, Pat.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I love birds. Like I told you before the show, I've had birds for years, but never the good big talking ones. So I'm kind of envious of your relationship.
I've learned from Cosmo that birds are highly intelligent. Crows are especially intelligent. Mm-hmm. And so now when I walk in the woods and listen to the birds, I have new respect for all of them.
I agree. Birds are very intelligent, as are all animals, actually, if we humans take the time to pay attention. Well, before we begin, would you share the story of Cosmo's first joke? I watched your YouTube video that you posted and just fell in love with her. So I just want you to share that little story with us.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about how Cosmo learned to talk. I got Cosmo when she was 6 months old, and she, of course, couldn't talk then. Parrots, African gray parrots, don't talk till they're about 1 year old. But I learned later that African gray babies stay with their parents for a whole year, and they learn how to chirp, you know, how to make their particular chirp from their parents. So every family has a slightly different accent. Every flock has a different accent. That's what we learned from digital recording equipment. But anyway, so I got Cosmo in May, the end of May of 2002. And I talked to her very simply, you know, Cosmo's a good bird. Cosmo want to go to kitchen. Cosmo want a peanut. I love you. And, you know, all that. And then, so that was all summer and all fall. And later I'll tell you about a joke she played on me before she could talk. But anyway, about the end of December, I was reading and Cosmo was perched on top of her cage and I heard Cosmo say, bird. Well, you know, I wasn't expecting that, so I didn't think much about it. And then I realized she was saying bird. And then she said, Cosmo is a bird. And by the end of the evening, 2 hours later, she was saying, Cosmo is a good bird. And those were her first words. And then when the phone would ring, let me tell you how she learned my name. My name is Betty Jean. And she didn't know my name for a long while, and she'd say in the morning, Cosmo won a shower. Time for shower for Cosmo. And I was still working then, so one day I said, time for shower for Betty Jean. And she looked up, you know, she's 6 inches tall, looked up on the floor. And said, shower for Betty Jean. And that's how she knew my name, learned my name.
Wow.
And so then when the phone would ring, I'd say, telephone for Betty Jean. And she'd say, telephone for Betty Jean. And then one day, maybe she mimicked the phone. I don't know if she does that. Or heard it. And she said, telephone for bird. And I burst out laughing, and she laughed, and I laughed. And I thought, my goodness, this is an amazing moment when two individuals of very different species are sharing a joke.
Oh, I love that. I just love that. And she has so much more of a repertoire with the phone. I heard her, she makes that phone ringing sound, and then she recites your phone number and says, you have reached 9354362. Thank you. Goodbye. Beep. And she laughs. It's just...
Yeah, and she laughs.
Tell self for her.
I love it. You said somewhere on your website, and I wrote this down because I loved it, somehow or other, it turned her, in my mind, into a feathery little person.
Yes. And, you know, when I look in her eyes, there's a person in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can tell I'm an animal lover. You know, she's just remarkable. She plays jokes on me. The first joke she played was when she was about 8 months old. She was in the kitchen and the smoke alarm went off, and I ran around and put on the fan, opened doors and windows, and you know, opened the oven door and all that. I was broiling Mexican chilies.
Oh,
and so this, you know, they smell really good.
Mm-hmm.
Where you live, but and I grew up in Texas, and I love the smell of Mexican chilies. And then a couple of months later, I was roasting Mexican chilies, and the smell, you know, the scent pervaded the kitchen. And Cosmo made this, well, I heard the sound of a smoke alarm. So I ran around, opened doors and windows, opened the stove, put on the fan, all that. And then when I'd look in the direction of the smoke alarm, it would go off. I'd look in the other direction, and it would go on again. And so finally I started wondering whether Cosmo was making that sound, because there was no smoke. And so I took the smoke alarm off the wall and moved it to the other side of the kitchen, turned my back on Cosmo, and the smoke alarm sound issued from her beak.
Oh.
And so she knew enough at the age of maybe 10 months that she was fooling me, because when I'd look at her, she wouldn't do it.
Mm.
And then I'd look away, and she'd do it.
Oh, so much going on there. I mean, you've got memory and this, you know, the scent and humor and, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Very intelligent.
So, in 2010, I wrote this little book called Conversations with Cosmo. And I had known for... years that I had to write a book about her, but I didn't know how to get started. And all of a sudden, one day it came to me that it would be Conversations with Cosmo, and then I would just tell how she learned to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book is lighthearted, but it is an absolutely true account of how Cosmo learned to talk and to be a good bird. And whenever I write about Cosmo or talk about Cosmo, I don't exaggerate at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm really tired of people writing in novels about how clever birds are, and they invent all kinds of things that the birds would never do.
Mm-hmm.
The birds are remarkable enough all by themselves. I put an African gray parrot named Doolittle in my second Witherston murder mystery, and Doolittle doesn't do anything that Cosmo wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
Or couldn't do. But Doolittle helps solve the mystery because of what Doolittle observes and repeats.
Mm-hmm. As I was looking at your background and thinking, you've published books in the fields of literature and history and politics, ecology and art. How was that then to write this book that was completely different from the previous ones?
It was different. Mm-hmm. I had to relax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always striven to write books that were readable to people outside my own discipline. You know, I just didn't have any patience with scholars who wrote so that only 100 other people could understand what they were saying. So I'd always wanted a large audience, but I had to relax and remember that I was writing the book for people who loved parrots or who loved animals but might not be academics. And so that enabled me to be funny and, you know, show my love for Cosmo and that sort of thing. So then it was after that it was after the newspaper discontinued my column Cosmo Talks because the newspaper shrunk in Athens, Georgia, that I started writing fiction. And that was also a new experience. But I've always liked learning curves, steep learning curves, because they're fun. You learn new stuff.
When you were writing that, was there something you wanted? Was that more of just fun for you or kind of a cathartic thing for you? Or was there a purpose that you wanted your readers to understand more about the intelligence factor of birds? What was your motivation?
I wanted people to understand that these parrots, and by extension, all animals, have thoughts and feelings and emotions. And so, my purpose, I had a lot of fun doing it, but my purpose is very serious. I wanted people to read the book and realize that birds have feelings and intelligence and should not be abused. You know, there are people, there's a Bird Talk magazine that I subscribed to a while back, and there were ads for these beautiful plastic cages that you could put in your living room, and it said, put your parrot in your living room so people could see your beautiful parrot. Well, that's, and then, you know, it was in a big plastic cage. I think Cosmo is out all the time when I'm home. Mm-hmm. And she knows, she walks around the house by herself. She tells me if she poops. She says, uh-oh, Cosmo poop on floor, and I'm supposed to run and clean it up. She tries not to poop on the floor. She never poops on me, and I'll cuddle her for, you know, a half hour while I'm writing. I write with my right hand then, and she'd cuddle her with my left. And, you know, when she wakes up in the morning, she says, calls out from her room. She has her own room. I'm here. And I go in, and she says, Cosmo want to poop. Cosmo want to go up. And so she wants to do her morning poop outside her cage. You know, so she goes up and does it on the newspaper. But I think it's remarkable that she knows that she needs to poop, and she's going to wait till I come get her and move her to a place where she can poop in peace. I didn't mean to have this radio conversation center on poop, but... But, you know, she talks about it quite a bit.
Well, she sounds like a child at a certain age. I love that bird. Let's move then from Cosmo to your mysteries. You have the first book called Downstream, and then your second book was Fairfield's Auction. And similar to your Cosmo books, there is a reason behind what you do. And in your book Downstream, I personally find your premise about pharmaceutical pollution and medicating our society via the environment to be spot on, because it's not, or it's no longer a fictional idea. It's happening right now. So maybe tell us a little bit about Downstream as we head towards your most newest book that you're writing.
Well, I had initially titled that novel, We All Live Downstream. I'd seen a bumper sticker. And the book is about pharmaceutical pollution of the environment, hormones that make people live to be 100 and more, but also do peculiar things to some of the women's bodies and to frogs and that sort of thing. So it's a little bit humorous. But my reason for writing it was to alert people to the fact that whatever we ingest goes into our environment, and others ingest our pills. We ingest other people's medicines. There's no giant flush that can, where we can get rid of what we create. And so that sounds kind of academic, but I had read, when I was teaching my last few years as a professor of comparative literature, I taught a course called Eco-Criticism. And one of the books that influenced me a lot was a book called Our Stolen Future. And it's about how we pollute our environment with hormones, you know, synthetic hormones, and tranquilizers and antidepressants, and then the frogs eat the tranquilizers and antidepressants and grow five legs. And, you know, it can have an effect of sterility on some creatures and that sort of thing. So that's has stayed with me for a long time. So I wrote downstream about that. But it's kind of funny, but it's a real murder, and two people get killed. And, you know, I was telling a friend, I love being a novelist, because when I decide to develop a character, I give the character a dog. And if I decide that I don't like a character, I make the character the object of crime. Or, you know, whatever. So that's really fun. And then I've lived in Athens, Georgia for more than 40 years. And I love the North Georgia Mountains. That's the Southern Appalachian Mountains. And I go up there a lot. And so the Cherokee people occupied North Georgia and Western North Carolina for 1,000 years before white settlers came and stole their land and their gold and sent them packing to the state of Oklahoma. And so the second novel, Fairfield's Auction, is about auctioning off Cherokee antiquities and all that means. But it too is a funny book. I hope it's funny. They're not meant to be funny, but the town I invented called Witherston has a lot of eccentric people in the town. And so they all get together and solve these mysteries.
Again, as I said before, it was a way for you to explore and share your philosophy on many different topics as well.
Right. And I'm an environmentalist at heart. Yes. So I don't know why I would write if I didn't have a message.
Mm-hmm.
My friends tell me I have to avoid being preachy about my message. I'm not a very preachy person, but when I write a novel, it's not just to entertain. It's primarily to entertain, but also to be thought-provoking. So I hope my novels are thought-provoking. In the third novel, which just came out in January, it's Dam Witherston, D-A-M. It's about the building of a dam, or the proposal to build a dam, on land that was occupied by the Cherokees. And some of the land was considered sacred by the Cherokees. And in that novel, I got into DNA ancestry because I'd sent off, you know, my spit to 23andMe, which is a DNA ancestry company,
right,
and found out, you know, where my ancestors came from. And I just started wondering, if everybody did that, we'd find that we're all related. Mm-hmm. And in North Georgia, a lot of people have Cherokee blood or Cherokee DNA in them. And, you know, maybe we would have fewer wars if we found out that we are related to each other.
Mm-hmm. Think about the similarities rather than the differences.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So where did you come up with your ideas for these?
I don't know. A Georgia novelist named Terry Kay told me that I should be writing fiction when I told him that my newspaper column had been canceled.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know how to write fiction. He said, oh, it's easy, I can do it. Well, he writes really good novels. But I'd always, when I was a child, I liked reading murder mysteries. And then all of a sudden, it just all came to me. And in 2 days, I had the beginnings of the plot. And, you know, once you get started, the characters sort of tell you where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one, this Dan Witherston, to me is the most interesting because it gets into genetic ancestry, and you know, there are a couple of rapes that have happened in, you know, 1977, and then 1828, I think it's 1828, and you know, so we can start mapping out history in a very different way with the use of genetic ancestry. You know, history for so long has just been told from the point of view of the victors you know, told according about documents and who is president, who is king, and that sort of thing. And the genetic ancestry will allow historians to see other kinds of relationships that have developed in the course of human history.
Mm-hmm.
I find that so exciting.
It is. It's very fascinating. And you mentioned your characters. Let's talk about them for a minute. Where do they come from? How do you build those characters?
I imagine them. You know, I have one friend who does yoga and is a pescatarian, and I have some friends who have twin boys who are very smart, and they've grown up now, and they're at the University of Chicago, and so I learned a little bit about how smart twins talk to each other. And then, you know, so I just started creating these characters. In the novels, in those Witherston novels, there's an online newspaper to which a whole lot of people contribute. So there's a weatherman, and there's Aunt Lottie, and she's a retired historian who writes a column about the history of Witherston. So, and there's a cartoonist, and, you know, I have a friend, childhood friend, who's a very good artist, so she does the cartoons. And so the story, I wanted the reader to figure out the mystery himself or herself by getting information from lots of different sources.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to create a mystery where we just followed the detective and found out what the detective had found out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want the reader to be able to piece it together maybe ahead of the main characters. And so each of those has a section called Webby Witherston, which is the online newspaper. And, you know, I really love doing that. I've just finished doing a very different kind of story, but I'll go back to doing Witherston mysteries, I think, when I finish with this one.
With the with your newest one?
The one that I'm finishing now,
mm-hmm,
is called Aldo.
Okay.
And it starts out with the president of a university, a very distinguished university, being kidnapped by somebody who calls himself Aldo and who wants the university to discontinue a particular program in genetic engineering and to fire a tenured professor. So in the novel, I get into, you know, issues of academic freedom, but also what it means to change the genome, you know, in reproductive cells, which means changing it for all succeeding generations. So, you know, I think that's really interesting. So again, this novel isn't as funny as the others because the characters are more normal. But it still gets into issues that I think we all ought to think about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've heard all my life writers say, write about what you know,
mm-hmm,
about.
Mm-hmm.
I read somewhere that some famous writer said, write about what you want to learn about. And that's what I do. Now, in this book, Aldo, it's a lot about university interactions. And I've been at the University of Georgia I was there for 38 years, so I know a lot about academic governance and that sort of thing. But I also know that if I'm writing a novel, I'm going to live in it for a year or so. And I want to be living in a world where I'm learning something new all the time. And it's so easy. I sit in front of the computer with Cosmo. Cosmo's about to talk. Behind me. And if I don't know something about science or whatever, I just Google it. And then I can learn,
yes,
about it.
Yep.
That's how I learned all about the Cherokees in North Georgia.
See, that's great. It keeps you learning and sharing at the same time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to write a book about something that I didn't want to live through, because that becomes your life.
Yep. That's true. As you're writing, that's what you're thinking about almost 24/7. So you might as well do something,
yeah,
you enjoy or something you can learn from.
That's right.
Yep, absolutely. Well, tell us a bit about your publishing process. How did that go for you?
Just wonderfully well. Not always. when I first wrote Downstream, which is calling We All Live Downstream, I thought that I'd like to get a New York publisher, and then I needed an agent, so I got a book and looked up agents, and I had a hard time finding an agent. And so you can't get to a New York publisher without an agent. And I don't have a lot of patience. So then I got a directory of small presses and found Black Opal Books, which isn't real small, but it publishes romances, thrillers, and mysteries. And my mysteries are called cozy mysteries, because there's not a lot of blood and gore and not a lot of explicit sex, mm-hmm. no porn. And I have nothing but praise for Black Opal Books. It's a really good publisher. I have a close relationship with my copy editor and a fun communication with the artists of the covers and the acquisitions editor. So that has been a pleasure. And they've given me a contract for my thriller. I guess it's a thriller. Anyway, there's kind of a mystery, and so I'm appreciative of them.
Well, that's exciting that you found a publisher you could stick with on your very first book.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I certainly will stick with them. I hope they stick with me.
I'm sure they will. There's no reason.
Cosmo just asked me if I wanted to go for a walk.
Oh.
Should I put her on speakerphone?
Please do, yes.
Cosmo, want to talk?
Hi, Cosmo.
Hello.
She barked at you.
Cosmo, I love you. I love you.
I love you.
Well, she's trying to hold the phone with her foot. Sometimes she looks in the mirror and she says, Cosmo has feet.
Oh.
Raises a foot. And she says, Cosmo has a beak. And she bangs her beak on the mirror. And sometimes she says to me, Betty Jean, want to kiss feathers? Then that means I'm supposed to go behind her and kiss her back.
Oh, my gosh. And she learns very quickly. It's not like you have to repeat something over and over. It sounds like she just picks it up.
Oh, I never taught. People say, did you teach her to talk?
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't teach her to talk. I talked with her
in
kind of a simplified manner, and she learned to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And she got a big vocabulary of more than 150 words in her first year or two, and she's the subject of a PhD dissertation, an MA thesis and a PhD dissertation from a young woman who was here then. But after she was maybe three or four, she stopped learning new words,
mm-hmm.
and she has a big enough vocabulary that she can use all the words she knows to make sentences that, to let me know what she wants. But there are some things where she has limitations. She just learned about three food words, peanut, orange, and I don't know, maybe the third one was grape. She doesn't use it very much. But now she just uses peanut to mean she wants something good to eat.
Food, okay. Interesting. I just love the whole idea of context. I mean, she understands that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
She speaks intelligently.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Cosmo. She's listening. Sometimes she's really good, and she just listens to me.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, like when I'm talking to a computer techie trying to fix a problem on the computer, she'll talk the whole time.
Well, she was being very polite today. I appreciate that.
Very polite. Yeah.
Very polite bird. Well, we've covered a lot today. We've talked about your book, Cosmo Talks, and three mysteries and the upcoming thriller, Aldo. Is there anything that we missed that you would like to talk about today?
No, I think we've had a good conversation. My Witherston murder mysteries and conversations with Cosmo are most easily bought online at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, or any bookstore can order them.
All right. And then why don't you share your websites and any other contact information you'd like to offer?
My website, which may soon undergo a renovation, is, I have two websites. One is BettyJeanCraig.com. Craig is spelled with an E on it. Betty Jean Craig, BettyJeanCraig.com. And then Cosmo has a website, cosmotalks.com, cosmotalks.com. And if you go to that website, at the bottom of the first page on your screen, you can get to Cosmo's YouTube channel. So as you know, Cosmo has about 6 YouTube videos, and then you can hear her talk.
And I've watched them all, so I highly suggest folks go to both of those websites, BettyJeanCraig.com and CosmoTalks.com. You will be just thrilled at what you find out about this wonderful, wonderful bird. Betty Jean, it has been such a pleasure to spend time with you and Cosmo in the background, and I just so appreciate having met you.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Pat, and I'm so happy to have met you.